From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, the 9th of December, 2019. And so happy to have you with us this morning. We got a good show lined up for you. I think we're going to be talking first with Xander Landon. He is politics and really a little bit of everything sometimes, reporter for vtdigger.org. And he's going to fill us in on some recent news developments in Vermont. Later on, we're going to have a guest from the Vermont Department of Health coming by and talking to us about joining a national panel on the problem of drug abuse and alcohol abuse in America. Although I should combine those together, really. It's always bugged me that people say alcohol and drugs. Alcohol is a drug, folks. I don't know if you've noticed that, having consumed any of it recently, but it is definitely there. And so we're going to be talking about addiction and what the federal government is going to be doing about addiction and how well that meshes with what the state government is doing in the latter hour of the program this morning. A little bit in the second part of this first hour, I'm going to actually fly solo for just a bit, maybe take some phone calls, but I have a real question about the question of divine right of kings. This all of a sudden is becoming a popular thing these days. We're hearing, people like Franklin Graham and Rick Perry and others, even Nikki Haley, talking about how President Trump may be in office ordained there by God. And what does that mean for our democracy? And can that really be so? And do we need to pay any attention to that? And et cetera. We're going to be talking about that. There was a fascinating essay over the weekend by a terrific writer named John Nassavera. He's a regular columnist these days in the Times Argus and Rutland Herald, and he writes frequently on the role of religion in public life and so on. And so I like Nassavera's writing and just thought we'd dig into his essay this weekend. Unfortunately, he tells me he's not a big fan of coming on the radio to talk about his stuff, so that didn't seem to be a possibility here, but we're going to be... we're going to talk about it anyway. So that's the deal here this morning on this, as we kick off the week here, just a couple weeks before Christmas. Can you believe it, folks? Wow, time is flying. And anyway, I wanted to get right to Xander Landon. He is right here in the studio with me this morning. And good morning, Xander. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Xander, you had a really interesting story the other day in vtdigger.org about the Vermont Department of Motor Vehicles making some money off of the sale of drivers and car vehicle registrants' personal data. What's going on?
Yeah, so this is a practice that's pretty common across the country, but I was able to get some documents and records that showed the extent to which it's happening in Vermont. And basically what's going on is that the DMV has access to, you know, a pretty broad and sweeping cache of personal information about all of the drivers in the state. Obviously, you know, when you sign up for a vehicle registration or you get your license, you're giving the state a bunch of information about yourself and about your vehicle. And that information is for sale, something that the department can sell under federal law without the consent of citizens that give that information to the state. So this has been something that's been going on for years, and it, like I said, it goes on in other states. But basically, I was able to get my hands on a record that showed that there are 700 government agencies, companies, and private entities that have been authorized to either buy or receive personal information about drivers over the last 15 years. And, you know, a lot of these companies are insurance companies who are sort of under federal law required to be able to buy that information. Then there are, you know, a handful of sort of out-of-state corporations that are using this information for a variety of reasons. And one piece that I, you know, was interested in is that, you know, there were about 50 private investigation firms that were authorized to receive information from the DMV. They use it over the course of their work and investigations, you know, that are going on associated with court cases, civil and criminal court cases. And after the story came out, the governor actually said that he didn't want private investigators to receive this information anymore, and he actually told the DMV to stop that as the state reviews the practice holistically. But the state has made a lot of money. It's been about $15 million over the last 4 years from selling the information.
$15 million over 4 years, that is a significant enough amount of money that I have to ask, if the DMV were to stop this, would they see a big hole suddenly in their budget that they would have to fill with, say, raising your annual license and registration fee?
I imagine it would create some problems. I don't know how much they rely or pad their budget with the revenue from this program, but in the state of Vermont, $4 million a year is a lot of money to all of a sudden cut off. I don't think that there's any plans to stop this practice anytime soon. As I said, it's really something that's mandated in some parts, in some ways, under federal law, especially with insurance companies and some larger trucking companies that sort of use the information to conduct background checks on employees, for example. But then on this list as well, there are a lot of small businesses in Vermont that use it, also presumably to be doing background checks on employees. This information that you can get, it's not only about, where you live and, your date of birth, et cetera. It's also about the vehicles that you own. It has your entire, these companies in some instances can access your entire driving record. So if you have any points against your license, if you've been stopped for traffic violations, in some cases criminal records, if you have a criminal record that sort of has a nexus to your driving history, that's also something that can be either given by or purchased by given to or purchased by someone, seeking it.
244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, 1-877-291-8255. Listeners out there, are you comfortable with the idea of the Department of Motor Vehicles selling off your information to private companies, which may want it for some legitimate reasons, may want it to keep track of how they should price, say, the sale of automobile insurance in Vermont, or any number of other things that would be difficult for us to think of off the top of our heads, frankly, I think as lay people who are not involved in the business. But, I think there always is this concern about privacy and this Big Brother invading our privacy and then giving away or selling too much of information that we thought would have been private, maybe some stuff that we are not automatically proud of. I mean, one question I had, there are some, when I saw the reference in the story to the potential for, say, a criminal conviction to be included in the information the DMV is giving out about people, I said, well, if it's a traffic offense, I could sort of get that, because they're going to have a record of that, and if they're selling off these records, well, that's a DMV record. What if it is something completely different? I don't know. You got busted for growing marijuana or something.
I think the information that they have that's related to one's criminal history is pretty limited to charges or convictions that would have a bearing on one's ability to drive in the state. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't necessarily be, if you took part in a burglary and were convicted or whatever. Yeah. I don't think that shows up. I think it's, if you're, it's obviously, DWIs and other, charges related to driving, or that would have a bearing on your ability, your privilege as a resident of the state to be driving here.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually think that is an important question there. And if in fact they are collecting up even criminal records not related to driving, I really have to ask why. I mean, why is that? Now, one thing I wanted to clarify also is that the other day, I understand Governor Scott came out and said, effectively, if I understand this right, declared a moratorium on some of these practices.
Yep.
What did that cover?
Yeah, it was specifically aimed at private investigators who, like I said, have been, as a practice, able to receive this information usually without actually paying for it. Usually private investigators can actually receive it without a fee for the last 20 years or so. The governor said he had concerns about that and has stopped it. And then, also there are some lawmakers now who are saying that they want to, they're planning on proposing legislation in 2020 that would restrict this practice as well. But for right now, private investigators cannot receive this information anymore, and a lot of them are pushing back and say that it's really important for them to be able to access this information, and that they're really only using it in the cases, you know, when they're conducting investigations that are connected to real ongoing cases in court, civil or criminal court, and that they need it, and that they should be able to access the same information that law enforcement have access to when they conduct their investigations, that it's only a matter of fairness. A lot of times, private investigators, for example, will be working on behalf of public defenders. So they say, you know, this is really an issue of, you know, equal access in the criminal justice system.
That is it's a fascinating question. I think Vermonters ought to be interested in weighing in about this, really, and letting their state officials know what they feel about this. Maybe this is okay, and everybody sort of expects that once was thought about our privacy has been diminished, and that's just the way the world works these days. I don't know exactly. We are going to chat a little bit now about the upcoming legislative session, because it is coming right up, folks. It's kind of amazing what we are into the shoot here. The legislature is already, you can see the parking lots fill up already around downtown Montpelier. It's kind of weird in this period of latter November and December when a lot of committees start meeting and get ready and, you know, sort of, okay, what are we going to be meeting about when we finally meet and that sort of thing. Got to have a meeting about the upcoming meeting, I always say. And Xander, one of the things that we're getting into this age of sort of perennial issues here, we have paid family leave, we have the minimum wage, tax and regulate marijuana or cannabis, I guess is the proper term these days. Let's start with that last one there, because it sounded like you had an interesting conversation about it over the weekend with a key person.
Yeah, so this bill, a bill that would basically legalize a recreational market for marijuana has passed the Senate in the last 5 years, I think five different times. Mm-hmm. So the Senate last year, after we've already legalized the possession and small-time cultivation of marijuana, passed a bill to make it legal, you know, for dispensaries or other institutions or stores to sell it.
Yep.
We can't, you know, right now we can't legally sell marijuana in this state. So they passed that bill, and now it's in the House. And the House got that bill pretty early last year in the session, I think somewhere midway through, and didn't do a ton of work on the bill. Well, maybe that's not fair. They did do a ton of work. They were sort of hammering out the details of the bill, but couldn't get it over the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is because House Speaker Mitzi Johnson and some others, you know, this for them has never been a top priority. It has never been, like it has in the Senate, there's never been a real urgency for them to legalize a cannabis market in the state of Vermont. There are some concerns that House Speaker Mitzi Johnson has about, you know, what this would do in terms of roadside safety, there being a need to make major investments in educational programs about drug prevention if we're also going to legalize a market. So she's been very concerned, and other House members have been very concerned about getting the details of this bill right, in their view, whereas the Senate is much less cautious. They're ready to go, and they have been for years, to legalize marijuana sales in the state of Vermont. And in my conversation with the Speaker on this over the weekend, she basically said that she's not going to say this has to get done this year. Mm-hmm. She's not going to say you have to move the bill and get this done. She's only going to say that at the point when she feels comfortable with the policy. And she has concerns, like I said, about the safety aspects of this. She also mentioned that she has concerns about what this could do to the environment in Vermont. She's pointing to Colorado and other states where you had major large-scale grow operations and companies come in and sort of do a lot of damage to the environment. Just based on the energy costs and I believe also water usage at these agricultural operations that grow cannabis. And she said she's very concerned about quote unquote big marijuana coming into the state. So she's indicating, she's signaling a lot of concerns, which you know may, you know, make it hard to pass this bill in the House this year. You know, the House Democratic, other House Democratic leaders have said it's a real priority to get this done. We got to do it in 2020.
Yeah.
We're not hearing that from her.
Is the Speaker actually opposed and just sort of coming up with new reasons every couple weeks for tapping the brakes? Or is she, is this really I'm trying to gauge, you know, kind of the the sincerity level, and also just the and if she is opposed, why doesn't she just come out and say, I think this is a dumb idea, you know, we'll consider it if you can meet the following hurdles. And by the way, I don't really expect them to be met anytime soon.
Well, you know, she says, you know, if the policy is right and we can get 76 votes, which is the minimum you'd need to pass it,
mm-hmm.
I'm fine with it. But she at the same time says, I think the word she said is, I've never been crazy about this.
Yeah.
It's not something that, you know, I think if it were up to her alone, would pass the state.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think she's willing to shepherd it through the process as long as it meets these criteria for her that are important. But no, she's not. I don't think she's I wouldn't call her a proponent or at least someone who's embracing this change. I think she was happy to go along with what we did 2 years ago in the state, which is just legalizing it in general, but not legalizing a market.
Yeah, I mean, my impression is definitely that she's I don't want to use the phrase not high on cannabis, but I mean, she just it doesn't really make her happy to think about this issue.
No, and her and the governor have a lot of the same, It's a very similar position on this.
Yeah, take it or leave it. Mostly leave it, and
mostly leave it. And if we have to do it X, Y, and Z way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there is some genuine enthusiasm though among her senior lieutenants in the House.
Yes.
And then the question is, of course, you know, to what degree is she susceptible to being, shall we say, brought along?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I spoke with House Majority Leader Jill Krawinski this past weekend as well, mm-hmm, and she mm-hmm. said, you know, we're gonna bring a bill to the floor. She okay. wouldn't say we're gonna pass it. She said we're gonna bring it to the floor this year as a guarantee. We're gonna do that.
Okay.
And she wants it done. She said last year, back in May, when the bill was clearly not gonna make it at the yeah. end, she said we're gonna get this done.
And listen, I'm seeing and hearing just in the sort of natural environment this thing is now developing through. You know, there is this sort of brake tapping going on or questions. I mean, one of them is the fact that in this whole concern about a national epidemic of vaping injuries, mm-hmm. most of the vaping injuries are, if not nearly all of them, are connected with THC consumption as
right.
opposed to the you know, the flavored nicotine.
Yep.
And that's got to be raising some concerns, because I think the vision of a lot of folks as of a couple of years ago was that vaping THC was going to be the new incoming thing,
right?
And you were going to go down to the little retail outlet and or your local reefer store and buy your vapor, mm-hmm. your vaping device and your material to load it with and all the rest of it, and go happily on your way. That all of a sudden has really come into question with this little health problem.
Oh yeah,
big health problem.
We are certainly going to see in response to this. I would be very shocked if we didn't see enacted in 2020 a ban on some vaping products.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, the likely product would be the flavored e-cigarette product. Mm-hmm. We've already, you know, we've seen the governor indicate that he would support that. We have lawmakers in the Senate and the House saying that they're going to do that. And then we also, you know, it's going to be interesting to see to what extent this will apply, or lawmakers are going to want to look into banning or restricting the use of THC vapes as well, because you're right. I mean, that's the CDC and others are saying that the majority of the illnesses that have been linked to vaping are vaping of THC
right.
Oil or.
And then you get into this morass of, well, is that really the black market talking in places where, I remember a New York Times story a couple months ago about a couple of young men in Wisconsin who were huge manufacturers, apparently, of these vaping cartridges that are used. And they were using a material, I guess, that has been linked to these problems. And the question is, can the industry itself respond in a way to come up with a new technique or materials that won't cause these problems? But boy, what a black eye coming out of the gate for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to create a new industry that is devoted to manufacturing and selling vapable cannabis, your stock just went down. It seems like in a big ugly way. So that all plays out at the same time. We have the sort of more standard and traditional fights in the state house about can we actually make meet the quote unquote concerns that we hear pop up. You know, highway safety is an issue. And can we measure, et cetera. Hey, Xander Landon, I am just shocked and amazed to say that we have blown through this first segment without trying hardly at all. And I really appreciate you coming in this morning. It's always good seeing you and talking with you, and I'm sure we'll do this again in the near future. We've got a caller on the line, Ted from Shelburne. I hope Ted can wait till after the break where we need to go for some CBS news right now. Thanks very much.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, and as I promised, if he's still there, I'm going to welcome Ted to our air this morning from Shelburne. Good morning, Ted.
Thank you for keeping your promise. Me too. The Physicians, Families, and Friends for a Better Vermont is a non-governmental organization, which, I mean, I have got to a position where I see their posts. I haven't been liking and sharing and commenting and so forth, but every day or two, there is a piece of probably provable information about the influence of marijuana. I know one medical doctor, who has children and who's very actively speaking, cautioning against legalizing or, use of marijuana. Mm-hmm. Talking to an emergency room doctor last summer, who was commenting on some of the fairly extreme cases that would come into the emergency room, and the question would be, are you smoking much marijuana as a side effect? And I know that the state sent legislators out to Colorado early on to investigate. So I wonder how it is with the oaths and beliefs and interests of our legislators that I haven't been hearing, and journalists. You know, this seems like not good for mental health, not good for medical health, when it goes astray, and it's likely to go astray increasingly. So anyhow, it's on Facebook that I see their posts, and I know that they're otherwise a perfectly good organization in the state. Physicians, Families, and Friends for a Better Vermont. So just because everybody's doing it, I live in Shelburne and on Route 7, I see a whole lot of disregard for caution and red lights. And just because everybody's doing it, I don't think we need to relax our position on trying to obey civil society. So it's just that this time.
Okay.
Mental health and so on is a very serious problem. Suicide is a serious problem. All of these things are relevant. Thank you.
I appreciate the call, Ted. Thanks so much for checking in with us. And, 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And, I promised before the actually right at the top of the show here that I would get into a subject which is dear to my heart, and I hope is dear to the heart of most Americans, and that has to do with some of our American history and the very founding principles of our country, because we have a national emergency, one might describe it, in one realm of our understanding of our U.S. history. Some of it, I think, does stem from the fact that we are nowhere near as well educated about our history as maybe some previous generations were about what developed in the United States of America back in the 18th century as the Americans approached their revolution and separated from Britain. One of the most important principles was the ending of a previous principle which had been known as the divine right of kings. The British crown was considered to be ordained by God. And, in the centuries leading up to the American Revolution, if you were the King of England, you were considered to basically be doing God's will and be beyond any sort of question or to be held accountable by the Parliament or by the people, by anybody around you, really. And the King of England went pretty extreme in the 1760s and 70s. King George III, of course, a lot of folks consider him now, historians now consider him to have been mentally ill, actually, and to have been engaged in a whole bunch of behaviors which were documented quite thoroughly in the Declaration of Independence as reasons that the United States would want to divorce itself from the English crown. John Nassavera is a columnist who writes every week for the Times Argus and Rutland Herald, and he's in their perspective section on their Saturday morning paper, and I frequently find his stuff to be in and of itself worth the price of admission for that newspaper. he's a very thoughtful guy. He's a retired professor from Columbia University with a specialty, I believe, in church history, and someone who really has studied a lot about the effects of the role of religion in public life in the United States of America. And he had a piece this weekend. I would love to have him on the program this morning. I've invited him on a couple of previous times, and he's been unable or unwilling. I guess he doesn't do radio, but I'm gonna lean hard on John Nassavera and his piece in the paper in the Times Argus and Rutland Herald these next few minutes here, because I think this topic is so important, and it is prompted, as he put it, by some statements made recently by luminaries ranging from Franklin Graham, the televangelist, and of course son of the probably granddaddy of televangelists, Billy Graham, the Energy Secretary Rick Perry has come out recently, even Nikki Haley, the allegedly moderate Republican governor, former governor of South Carolina, who was then the UN ambassador, is said to be a possible candidate if Donald Trump decides he's going to run for re-election with somebody, a running mate different from Mike Pence. We don't know about that, really, but Nikki Haley is on board with this, apparently. And they are all talking about Donald Trump as being somehow the chosen one or ordained by God or in some other fashion there because of God. Mr. Nassavera, this columnist, Professor Nassavera, I'll call him because he did have a long career at Columbia University, is a very thoughtful on this. It talks about the real problems for America and the idea of America and the very founding reason for America. He thinks, Nassavera seems to, that one of the main reasons to have created this country was specifically to break away from the idea that any leaders in our society, including the king or the president, could be there unquestioned because they are allegedly carrying the mantle of God somehow or another. And he starts out by saying, about a week ago, Preacher Franklin Graham and U.S. Department of Energy Secretary Rick Perry dropped bombshells that are causing me to write about something I would have never dreamed needed to be addressed in this country. Mind you, they are not alone. Others in their ilk have been saying similar things over the past few years. Perry stated point blank that God has chosen Trump to carry out his plan. Graham stated that those opposed to Trump may be acting under demonic influence. I'm not making this up. Just Google it. Graham and Perry are, knowingly or not, displaying a belief in something that used to be called the divine right of kings. What the heck is that, and how the heck did it just get brought back to life in America, of all places? The divine right of kings was something that had its roots to some degree in the medieval period. Both Augustine and Aquinas affirmed that the rule of emperors and kings was authenticated by God. However, it is crucially important to note they also said all secular rulers' powers must be exercised in ways that were never counter to Christian teaching or morality, meaning the power of the Pope and the Church trumped, pardon the pun, or pardon the expression he said, the power of kings. Those are two types of authority, sacred and secular, and the pre-Reformation Church taught and demonstrated that these two were often at odds with each other. Well, by the time, this is me talking now, I was just reading Nassavera, but by the time we got to the American Revolution, folks, you may recall there was this thing called the First Amendment in which it was determined that the United States government would take no stand on religion, either for or against. So therefore, it was not going to be a function of God. It was, the United States government was not going to be either a reflection or a refutation of the existence of God or the worship of any particular God or et cetera. And yet we have this now in 2019, very senior leading officials in our country, including the energy secretary and the former UN ambassador and many, many others in our Congress who have this idea that somehow President Trump, of all people, is ordained by God as he's supposed to be there, according to God. Now, I'm happy for listeners to call up and try to explain this to me and tell me how they consider, you know, how they justify that idea if they believe it. And I'm eager to hear from people. 244-1777-1877-291-8255. Rich from Huntington's on the line. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Dave. I realize probably in most matters you and I are at opposite ends of the political spectrum, but you know, you're putting a lot of weight in what a couple of public commentators have said about this, you know, divinity of kings thing on our current president. But I'd have to say, from my particular bias, if any U.S. president has been lofted by any private or particularly media figures as a divine figure, it was the previous president, Obama. And, you know, there's plenty of commentary made along those lines. But if I can just say something about Mr. Trump, our current president, one of the big issues that has come out with him, and as you mentioned, Franklin Graham's statements regarding his supposed divinity, he has taken upon himself the issue of, and this is not, there's never been, from what I've been reading, really never been any other U.S. president that has taken it upon himself to this degree to elevate the rights of religious expression the way Trump has. And that's one of the main reasons that this country was fighting King George. And the reason that people from Western Europe came over to this new world was to escape religious oppression. So that's one of the founding principles, and they don't teach that in school anymore. One of the founding principles of this country, ensconced in our Bill of Rights, in the First Amendment, is religious expression.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's all it says.
Yeah, and we have a president who has taken it upon himself to elevate that on a worldwide scale and bring...
So does he respect the establishment of religion?
No, not to impose our Constitution. I mean, I would love to see that happen. There's no copyright or patent on our Constitution. Any other country is free to adopt the U.S. Constitution, but there's some pretty astounding figures on the number of people who have been oppressed and or killed because of their religious affiliations in foreign countries, and our president has taken it upon himself to make that one of his cornerstone issues.
You know, I'm all for human rights around the country and around the world, and for the right for people to worship or not as they wish. And if I were advising the president of the United States, I would say that's a noble cause to say that the Uyghurs in China, if I'm pronouncing that right, who are Muslim, should be allowed to worship in the way they want. To say that Christian Kurds in northeast Syria and in Iraq should be allowed to worship the way they want. That is something that the United States, as a beacon of freedom historically, has actually pushed for. Certainly President George W. Bush was a big champion of that kind of thing. And yes, President Trump has as well spoken out about that from time to time. I you know, I question his sort of stick-to-itiveness and his sincerity when he suddenly pulls out of Syria and leaves these Christian Kurds to twist in the wind over there. But that's sort of another issue. I do think that this president, however, is really using his alleged fealty to Christian principles and his connections with people of Christian faith in a quite a cynical way. I can't really find that much that he does that is in keeping with the Gospels of Christianity. If you look at Matthew and you look at the Beatitudes, you look into the New Testament in general, I think you would find lots of places where just, you know, one line from the scripture that sticks with me a lot is, I was a stranger and you took me in. And you got to square that with the current immigration policy of putting little kids in cages. I mean, is that Christian?
Well, if I may, the president really shouldn't be promoting any particular views of religion and imposing them on the American people or on visitors to our country. But
yeah.
What I'm saying is that he, in a general principle, he's the first president that's gotten in front of the United Nations and said that, thrown out this 80% figure and saying 80% of the world's population live in places where they are not free to practice their religion without endangering their lives. And that 80% figure is kind of scary when you get right down to it. So he's not, and he has mentioned Uyghurs and Christians and Buddhists and Hindus as being, depending on where they live, being oppressed. So, I mean, he's not really picking and choosing a particular religion. He is, in a general sense, promoting the concept of religious freedom in a way that's greater than I can think of any president in history promoting.
As any U.S. president should, really. I mean, in terms of religious freedom. One last thing. You mentioned that Obama had been deified or whatever by people in the media. Can you cite me anything?
I can. It's a general sense. I mean, just since you brought it up, I'm not really thinking that anybody now is deifying. I know there have been a few.
I named you names. I named you Nikki Haley.
Franklin Graham, and I understand
Franklin
that.
Graham, I mean, Rick yeah. Perry. That's in the past week. Okay. There are three famous, nationally known people in the past week. Can you name me three famous, nationally known people in the entire 8 years of the Obama administration who claimed that Obama was ordained by God to be president?
Not specifically.
I didn't think so.
But there was a sense of
Rich, thanks for the call. I got some other callers coming in. Thank you very much. Let's go to Jim in Barrytown.
Dave?
Yep.
Hi, Dave. Hey, listen, when I graduated from Spalding High School back in the 70s, I went off to Bible college to become a minister in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
And I studied the scriptures extensively. Now, why could this be an antichrist or not that big according to the book of Revelation?
Could Trump be
could
an
Donald
antichrist?
Trump be, yeah.
You know, I'm not a scholar of religion. I will fess that up right off the bat. Mr. Nassavera, who writes these columns, apparently is in the Times Argus and Rutland Herald. They're well worth reading. I don't know if you read them, but man, he's
I do all the time.
Very interesting writer.
When I went to Bible college after graduating from Spalding in the 70s,
yep.
I got kicked off the campus because I started a Christian rock and roll band.
The Christian rock's a big thing now in some places. So
you were a man ahead of your time. Yeah. Hey, and by the way, you may not recognize my voice, but do you remember Played Against Sam when it burned down?
I do.
And you were at the concert, and you lost your kid?
I do. I remember that as well, yes.
I was the guy playing the accordion.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, yeah. It's amazing the connections we make through this show. It's a small community around here, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And it's a great show. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jim. Have a great one. Bruce from Essex was waiting. Bruce, I hope you're sticking around, are you?
I'm on. Thanks, Dave.
Excellent.
You're very courageous to bring up this subject on the air. As you know, I have a long background in politics,
yep.
But I don't consider myself an expert there ever since I said Donald Trump will never be president of the United States. But I also have a master's in graduate theology from St. Mike's, and I'm not an expert there either, but I remember I was asked to do a sermon at a Lutheran church, and I was asked to talk about the prophets. And there were prophets who served the court, the kings of Israel, and they made money from it. They got favors because they told the court what the court wanted to hear. And then there were the prophets like Amos and others who were outside the mainstream and were challenging. And one of the things the books I read says the way to determine, you know, the truth of prophecy or not is time, and also were those being making a false prophecy in the employ of the court. Well, I look at Haley, I look at Franklin Graham, I look at Rick Perry. They all have something to gain by peddling what I consider to be this blasphemy. I mean, how do they know? I mean, I always, when someone comes to me with a great deal of certainty about something, I say, well, is God right-handed or left-handed? Does he or she have blue eyes? And so you always have another point of view. You always have something you can find in Scripture, whether it's the Hebrew Testament or the Christian Testament, to, you know, to defend a point of view. But there are certain tests that you have to do, and you have to divorce yourself from your own personal gain. So there you go.
Yeah, I suspect you're right, Bruce, to try to broaden the discussion here a little bit, because it is, and then, you know, you could even stretch it out beyond the Judeo-Christian tradition. I always love the line from the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu scripture, about there are many paths out up the mountain of faith.
And, absolutely.
And I've heard people add commentary to that, indicating that, but when you get to the top, the view is pretty similar. It's so.
Or the guy who scaled the mountain to see a wise man, and he said, "What's the secret to life?" And the wise man said, "Well, it's a banana." And the guy goes, "What? You don't know? You know? I mean, just we get unexpected answers when we look for gurus. We also have to look inside ourselves, and we have to look at our level of tolerance, because that's what it's all about eventually.
That is what it's all about eventually. I hope not just eventually, but I hope real soon. Hey, Bruce, thank you for the call. That's really a great way, I think, to tie up this segment here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. We're going to be going to a top of the hour CBS News break here in just a few seconds. I wanted to mention quickly first our podcast. Don't forget, go to WDEVradio.com. Follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You can come up with a list of our recent programs by guests and by topic, and you can actually listen to your heart's content any time of day or night to the Dave Graham Show, thanks to the internet. All right, CBS News upcoming. A couple words from our sponsors, and then a CBS one-on-one correspondent chat, and we will continue into our second hour in just a couple of minutes, folks.
This is Jack from the Warren Store, wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season, and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker, and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants, and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, continuing into our second hour of the show this morning, and going to be speaking, I think, very shortly with, I believe it's Steve Dorsey from CBS News. We're getting into our regular one-on-one conversations with our CBS News friends, and that's a real valuable thing I think we can bring here to WDEV, FM, and AM, get a little more laser focus on some of the stories they're covering down there. Of course, I think we're going to be talking with Steve about the impeachment proceedings, which are actually continuing today. The House Judiciary Committee is hearing from lawyers about how the committee may wish to draft articles of impeachment directed at President Trump. The committee was met last week on Wednesday and had a spirited set of testimonies from three lawyers, three law professors, I should say, representing Democrats, one for the Republican membership of the House committee. Of course, the Republicans are in a minority here, so they get a little bit less of an edge here in just in terms of the way the thing seems to be structured and broken down and so on. When things go over to the Senate, the House, of course, is expected to pass articles of impeachment over to the Senate. When these articles reach the Senate, they are going to be in a different world. It's going to, the Senate is a Republican majority body, of course, and the real question is going to come down to will this entire proceeding. I'm hoping, you know, the senators actually take an extra oath as they begin the impeachment hearings to leave partisanship aside and actually to do right and justice under the law. And we all have to hope for the best, I guess, and hope that that extra oath that they take at the beginning of these proceedings will be a reminder that it's not all about politics. And the I've said this on the radio numerous times previously, if Bernie Sanders had somehow gotten elected in 2016 and had committed many of these behaviors for which President Trump is in trouble these days, I would be fully in support of Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton. Either one of them, if they'd been elected in 2016 and had behaved in this way, if they had really sought to do severe damage, it's still an open question whether it'll succeed, but sought to do severe damage to the separation of powers, the whole idea that the Congress is, and the courts are co-equal branches with the executive in our system of government. If they had done that, I would be fully in support of removing either Sanders or Clinton from office. And so no one should be surprised when I'm thinking that this stuff is very, very serious and probably needs to be concluded at some point with removal from office. Whether that will happen here, I think, frankly, is doubtful. I think a lot of people see that as doubtful because the final decision is probably going to be made by the United States Senate. And so we'll have to see what unfolds. But those are the stakes, folks. I think it's a very, very serious time for our country and for anybody to be able to say in 10, 20, 100 years, we can still rely on these structures of government we all learned about in school, where you have these co-equal branches called the Congress and the executive branch and the courts, and they all keep each other in check and balance and all that sort of good thing. The president has basically been taking the stance lately that he can do what he wants. Congress asked for witnesses to come up to Capitol Hill and detail what they've been doing, and the president can thumb his nose at that. Congress asked for documents to demonstrate what the folks involved in his administration have been doing. He can thumb his nose at that in the view of the executive branch. And, you know, if that's all okay with you, then I just want you to know that probably means we aren't going to have what the traditional democracy that we used to have in this country for very much longer. So, as I say, the stakes are really large, and we're going to find out, I think, a little bit about what's going to be happening with the impeachment proceedings in Washington. As I mentioned, the House Judiciary Committee meeting this morning to try to actually get some advice for what the specific language might be in the articles of impeachment. Let's talk with Steve Dorsey from CBS News about this. Steve, how are you doing this morning?
Good.
So, Steve, fill me in. Am I getting this right, roughly, that basically the job today is to start to talk about, you know, what should be in and what should be out on the articles of impeachment?
Yeah, that's a good point. We will be hearing from lawyers. We've already heard from one lawyer for the Democrats who will outline the case for impeachment that Democrats have built up. And this will go and help guide this Democratic-led committee, the House Judiciary Committee, to begin drafting and writing and finalizing those articles of impeachment, those charges against the president. Of course, we'll be hearing from Republicans as well today who will try to refute that case.
Yeah, and these articles are allegedly going to be drafted up within the next couple of weeks and potentially voted on by around, I guess, the 21st or so?
Yeah, that's the goal, but it will really come down to the clock, because Democrats also have to deal with funding the government with a deadline.
Oh, yeah, that little thing.
So the clock will be ticking, so it's possible they could do this late next week as they leave jet fumes in their wake to get home to their districts for the Christmas and New Year recess.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty tight. I mean, a lot of times this time of year, though, you see Congress doing rather amazing and unusual things to try to get their work that they've been putting off all year done in time for sort of a holiday end of year deadline and that kind of thing. But this, of course, adds this extra layer of this giant extra layer of impeachment considerations here. Now, I saw some speculation the other day that, I can't put my finger exactly where this came from, but I bet you've heard it, that it would be possible for the Democrats, if they wanted to, in the House, I mean, to essentially draft up articles of impeachment, even pass them on the House floor, but it takes a separate vote, actually, to then transmit them to the Senate, correct?
Yeah, this is true. So there's a lot of layers still to get through in this impeachment probe,
mm-hmm.
We'll be learning more about that in the next few weeks.
And the would it be possible for the Democrats to kind of start developing, I don't know, a shelf of articles of impeachment? We're going to put these by in the canning jar, so to speak.
I think they're shooting high, Democrats, for several articles of impeachment, including obstruction, including abuse of power, and that allows some moderate Democrats, perhaps, according to some political analysts, to vote against some of these articles of impeachment while still advancing impeachment against the president into the Senate, but help with their own reelection purposes.
And could the Democrats then say, you know, they've been trying to get the people like Pompeo and Bolton and Mulvaney and even Giuliani to come testify. And the president, of course, has been putting his thumb down on that and saying not happening. I could imagine a scenario where the Democrats are sort of maybe every week or so adding another article of impeachment, depending on what they've gotten through and so on. It's kind of ratcheting up the pressure on the president and saying, Mr. President, you want us to get this done. You say you want a fast procedure. You want it quickly over to the Senate so the Senate can go ahead and exonerate you. The quicker you give us Bolton, the quicker you give us Pompeo, the quicker you give us Giuliani, the quicker this is going to go.
Yes, but I think the president has made it clear he's not going to cooperate at all with the House, and I think the House realizes he's not going to cooperate. So although they want those witnesses like Bolton, the best chance, I think, for that is Democrats in the Senate. However, they might have to give up some of their own witnesses, including Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, perhaps the whistleblower, and those are all key pieces of the chessboard that I don't think Democrats want to easily give up.
That is an interesting facet of this thing, of course. My own sense of this thing, I mean, we'll see what the Inspector General report says today. We'll see what Mr. Durham up in Connecticut finally reports in a week or two when he produces his statement back to William Barr on what he's found in his investigation of this allegation that there was a lot of nefarious dealings at the beginning of the Russia investigation. Those two people have been looking into that allegation, Horowitz and Durham. So right. Now Horowitz and Durham come back and they say, it wasn't beautiful, but it wasn't criminal or ugly or anything, really. It was just sort of meh. So now we're back to it looks like if you stand up the, you know, Bolton versus Hunter Biden. I'm thinking I want that Bolton chess piece more than I want that Hunter Biden chess piece, don't I?
Yeah, it's true. And that's a calculation I think Democrats are going to have to work through. And it's a calculation that I think could be very divisive for the party at a time when the party under Nancy Pelosi needs to be united according to her strategy.
What'll be the dissension in the Democratic ranks about?
Well, I mean, listen, you've got a progressive wing who is backing candidates on the presidential trail like Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And then you have more moderates, longtime allies of Joe Biden and his presidency, who worry that calling Hunter Biden and calling Joe Biden to testify could be a distraction, validate some of the president's concerns, and could hurt his reelection his presidential election campaign. And those are all factors I think Democrats are trying to consider.
Wow, lots of different hooks here. Steve Dorsey, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's good chatting with you.
Great to talk to you.
All righty. Hey, that's going to have to about do it for this segment of the Dave Graham Show. Let's go to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour. And when we come back, we are going to be speaking with Cynthia Sievright of the Vermont Department of Health about alcohol and drug abuse, etc. We'll be back shortly.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back. As I promised before the break, we are going to be talking about alcohol and drug abuse in the state of Vermont and in the country at large, really, maybe the world at large. It is a large problem, that is for sure. And one of the people working in the working to address it for, I don't know exactly how long, maybe we'll find that out in the next few minutes, is Cynthia Sievright of Essex Junction. She's director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs at the Vermont Department of Health and recently got a very interesting sounding appointment to a federal panel looking at these same kinds of issues. I believe Cynthia Sievright is on the phone with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Thank you for having me.
Glad to do it. Tell me about your appointment. What's the panel and what do they do?
So this is the Interdepartmental Substance Use Disorders Coordinating Committee.
And it That's why I asked you to say it.
Oh, yeah. I know it's very long. Yeah. And it is required under the Federal Support Act, and that was an act that was passed a couple of years ago. And this act funds a large number of programs throughout the country addressing opioid addiction. The funds go into a number of federal agencies and then goes out to the state. So the purpose of this coordinating committee is to coordinate all of those resources and activities across all the federal agencies and align the federal strategies with what's going on in the states.
Does that give Vermont a little bit of a leg up now to have a Vermonter on this panel that's overseeing the distribution of these funds?
I hope so. That's one of the reasons we were pretty excited about having a voice at that table. We are a rural state, which is different than most of the states in the country, and we do have some of the special needs that come from that, accessing services, transportation, and also we've been a leader in how to address the opioid crisis, and to have a voice at that table, I think not only will benefit us, but benefit other states.
Yeah, I know Vermont is kind of famous for its hub and spoke system, just for instance. And tell us a little bit about that and whether that is replicable in other places.
Yeah, it's a system that we created several years ago. It was an opportunity we had with a Medicaid waiver, and it was a joint effort between the Medicaid office and the Health Department's Division of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, and we created a model that was a health home model and addressing the opioid addiction from the lens of a chronic illness, a chronic disease. And so it's a model where it's paid differently than the rest of the services were. We use the Medicaid dollars in a way that you got a bundled payment so people can provide a variety of services. People get really intensive services in one place, and as they need less intensive services, they can move out into primary care doctors' offices to get the services. This model actually has been replicated, or at least very similar to what Vermont is doing across the country over the past couple of years, and using the funding that's coming out of the Support Act, states are setting up models that are very similar to Vermont's. And our staff here at ADAP have traveled across the country in the past couple of years helping states to get this model up and running.
How many states have adopted it now, do you know?
I don't know. I know Colorado definitely has because they just presented at a national meeting. I think we have about around four or more states that are really close to the model. New Hampshire is doing something like it as well. They're pretty new at doing that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I suppose in some states you're going to have areas of the state where a sort of rural hub and spoke system might make sense in other areas of the state. I mean, you know, you think of a place like New York, where obviously you have the New York metro area, and then you have the the vast parts of the state that are up in the Adirondacks and out in western New York State, mm-hmm. and so on. So probably a blend in some of the larger states, isn't it?
It is a blend, yeah. They tweak the model a little bit to meet the needs of the community. So part of the challenge can be having enough physicians who are willing to prescribe and take on the patients. So in the hub, when you have the concentration of individuals and you have your doctors right there, but when they need to be sent out once they've stabilized, it's finding the doctors that are willing to take on the number of patients that are needed sometimes can be challenging, especially in the rural areas.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, because it seems to be coming back into the news. I mean, it never really left the news completely, but maybe the type size on the headlines is getting a little larger again, and that is cannabis. And I guess we've been reading about cannabis in connection with this vaping injury epidemic around the country. And, you know, Vermont, of course, is going to be, we have a new legislative session coming up next month where some folks under the Golden Dome are still talking about creating a retail system of some kind for sales of marijuana in Vermont that would, I gather, be similar to what's already been going on in places like Colorado and more recently Massachusetts. What is the health department's stance on the idea of retail sales of recreational cannabis in Vermont?
Well, I think it's a controversial issue, mm-hmm. and we know that cannabis is addictive, it's harmful, and we've done a health impact assessment that was put out a few years ago. We've updated it in 2017, and we're continuing to get more information. We want to make sure that our treatment system is available to people who have a problem with cannabis, who want to stop cannabis. So one of the things that we're doing in the alcohol and drug abuse program is we're making sure that our provider system is able to be available to people, have the treatment services that are needed out there.
And a couple of things have sort of come to the fore with cannabis in a couple of years. It's been, well, I guess now a year and a half or so since Vermont actually legalized possession of up to an ounce of cannabis, and also the cultivation of a small number of plants, if I recall. I don't recall all the details of that law because it was a fairly dense piece of legislation. But I'm wondering, do you see the impact of cannabis in Vermont? Has it lessened in that time? Has it grown worse? Is it about the same? Or how do you feel just its overall role in the society of our state has changed, if at all, in those last 18 months?
Well, we do get data on the use of cannabis in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in our 2018 data that we have right now, we do know that more than 1 in 10 women report using cannabis during their most recent pregnancy. So we know that we have a problem there. We have another data source that shows that 24% of high school youth reported using cannabis in the past 30 days.
Let me stop you if I could and ask you about those two figures. And what I'm really curious to know is kind of the impact of the limited legalization to which Vermont has gone so far. And so do we have any sense that if it's more than 1 in 10 women have smoked cannabis during their last pregnancy, is that what you said?
Yes,
okay.
And that's from the 2018 data.
Okay, so maybe it's too soon to know, you know, really have current data on this or whatever. But I'm very curious to know. So then we make this change in the law, and does that make it go to, you know, more than 2 in 10 women smoking, or does it change it at all? Does it somehow make it go less? Who knows? But you see what I mean?
I do, yep, and we don't have that data yet. We are, hopefully that data is going to be coming out very soon, the most recent data, to see what that trend, what's happening in the use across the state.
One thing I noticed a few months ago, I don't know really whether any correlation has been made here, but people, of course, one of the big stumbling blocks to even getting as far as the legislature did on legalization was this concern about road safety, traffic accidents tied to cannabis use, basically. It looked like some of the road safety figures were becoming markedly safer on our highways. I don't have the fatality statistics, easy for me to say, in front of me, but it looked like they were way down over the first year or so.
Yeah, I don't have the current data on that. We have been working with law enforcement across the state to look at how are we going to measure that. What mm-hmm. is the tool that we're going to be able to identify when someone's impaired? What is how do you measure the impairment to say when someone is safe to drive or not safe to drive when they're using any yep. substance? So that's going to be one of our challenges during the session, is to figure out how to keep the public safe. And I don't have the data in front of me to know about what the impact is currently on.
It's also, I'm frankly skeptical, and I think that's just my nature. I was a long time reporter in Vermont, and reporters tend by nature to be skeptical. And I used to hear people say it's going to be a disaster for road safety when we legalize marijuana. And I would say, well, I don't know if there'll be that direct a correlation. I guess we'd need years of data to really figure that out. And maybe it would be kind of interesting to learn from these data indicating, for some weird reason, a significant decline in fatal traffic accidents, if that in fact is what is happening, that, well, gee whiz, there really isn't as much correlation as some people might have feared. Not to say that being stoned causes fewer traffic accidents or anything like that, but just that maybe the link that people have made between these issues is thinner than might have been evident at first glance, or at least apparent at first glance. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And as far, I also wanted to, I mentioned to Matt Simon, who is with the Marijuana Policy Project, that we were going to be doing a segment. And Matt has actually called in. He wasn't formally scheduled as a guest here, but I want to bring him in for a minute since he's on the phone. Matt, what's your read on this? Do you see anything that's discernible yet from this 18-month experience?
Well, good morning, Dave. Thanks for inviting me. I haven't actually looked at the numbers. I'm not aware of any numbers. All I really know is what I hear from Vermonters that I talk to, and it certainly seems evident that there hasn't been a major change in life in Vermont. People who were using cannabis before are still using it, with the change being that they're allowed to grow their own now, where they weren't previously, but what we're really trying to get to is a regulated market here so that we can actually address some of the concerns that your other guest has brought up. Having an unregulated system does nothing to keep marijuana away from kids. It does nothing to educate consumers. It does nothing to protect the health of consumers. They don't know the content of what they're consuming. They don't know whether it's 5% or 25% THC. They don't know whether it's covered with molds or pesticides or heavy metals or who knows what. And now we have the vape cartridges that are making people truly sick. These people in their basement are making concentrates and loading them up with thickeners like vitamin E acetate, and those are causing serious health problems. We're not going to be able to solve this problem until we regulate the supply chain.
That's Matt, let me stop you there for a sec, because I want to get a couple of these and just see if Cynthia Sievright, the director of alcohol and drug abuse programs at the Vermont Department of Health, has any thoughts. That Cynthia, well, one of the issues here is the vaping epidemic. From your knowledge of that issue, is it true that we're seeing most of the illnesses and lung injuries connected with vaping, further connected with THC vaping? Is that right?
Yeah, most of the patients report a history of using products containing THC, mm-hmm. Particularly those that they got from what we call informal sources,
yep.
including friends and people on the street. That is true.
So Matt seems to be making this argument that if we had a regulated system, I mean, let's take another drug, and I'm going to argue in a moment that alcohol is a drug, even though in the title of your agency and in a lot of the literature, people constantly refer to, quote unquote, alcohol and drugs as if they're something different. But alcohol, if I go down to the liquor store in Montpelier where I live and I buy a bottle of gin or whiskey or something, I have a pretty good sense of what's in there. And I have, I have a pretty good sense of the strength of the liquid that I'm buying in this bottle. And one of the reasons for that is because we've had 80 or 90 years now of regulation of alcohol in Vermont and elsewhere in the country. And the whole industry is very tightly regulated and one of the most heavily regulated industries in the country, really. And does that model make sense for cannabis?
I think that it does.
Mm-hmm.
It, for the same points that you just made, without the regulation, we don't know what's in it. We can't control the potency of it. We can't control the access. We definitely do not want children and adolescents to have access to it. Even regulating how it's tested, whether that, you know, not letting the businesses do their own testing, that it should be done by an independent lab. Even the packaging, how do we regulate the packaging so that it isn't desirable for children to look like candy if it's going to be edible? So we at the health department support the regulated system. If we're going to have a legal system in Vermont, it needs to be regulated.
That's an interesting observation coming from someone at the health department itself, because I mean, and it kind of makes sense, because you, after all, I would think would be as a health professional, somebody who is fully supportive of really, really solid labeling on food. We want to know what our ingredients are. We want to know, make sure there aren't adulterating ingredients in whatever materials we're ingesting, whether it's cannabis or alcohol or crackers, you know, and so it does make sense, and that is interesting. Matt, I wanted to ask you about a couple of things about this industry, and one is that there are these folks out there who are making apparently vaping cartridges containing some sort of fluid or whatever that's making people sick. What about the ethics and responsibility of that? What should people know about the quote unquote marijuana industry at this point?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, the cannabis industry, the legitimate licensed industry, wants to be able to serve this market, which is a many billion-dollar market in the United States. They want for the Americans who use cannabis to be able to access products that aren't going to kill them or put them in the hospital. And, you know, the states that have regulated systems have been able to implement protocols, make sure that there isn't vitamin E acetate. This was identified by the CDC recently as what's actually killing people and putting people in the hospital.
Let me stop you there, because I really want to nail that down. We have actually, that's the bug right there, vitamin E acetate.
Well, it's at least one of them. I mean, mm-hmm. they're also finding high levels of pesticide in these concentrates. And, you know, we know there isn't high levels of pesticides in a lab-tested cartridge in Massachusetts. And if their regs aren't all the way where they need to be yet, they can update them, because they have an agency that regulates cannabis production and sale. But if we don't have that, what we have, and Leafly has done some excellent investigative reporting into this, but basically Chinese companies that used to make cheap plastic toys are now making cheap plastic vaporizer cartridges that any business in the United States can buy huge boxes of them very cheaply and then fill them with their own whatever, and they can buy their own packaging that looks halfway legitimate. It looks like something you might have bought in a store. And consumers need education. They need access to regulated products. It's the only way we can ever truly say that we're taking a public health approach to cannabis. And I'm really encouraged by your guest's previous comment.
Let me go back to Cynthia Seabright, because there's another issue connected with cannabis that I think is worth mentioning here. And that is, before I do that, because they kind of tie together, one more for Matt, which is, Matt, I have a good friend who enjoys smoking cannabis, and sometimes actually tells me he finds some relief from smoking cannabis, not really in a medical context, but just for some pain he's dealing with. You know, he's getting older now, and he has some pain issues. And boy, the cannabis provides nice relief. But he says, his quote is, "It's way too strong these days. It's not like the reefer I used to smoke back in the 70s." Is the way he puts it. You know, and
well, I would invite him. So I hear that all the time, and I would invite him to visit a regulated store in Massachusetts or any other state, where you can look at the menu and see what the THC level is in every single product that you want. If somebody is a daily consumer or a medical patient who's using large amounts, they're going to have a much higher tolerance than somebody who takes a puff every once in a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, with alcohol, we have access to that wide range of products. With cannabis, we don't, unless we have access to the regulated market, which,
well, if I go to
market, it will provide for what consumers want.
If I go to that, to, I guess there's a store down in Northampton, Mass, right off I-91, a little south of Brattleboro. Mm-hmm. If I haven't been down there, but if I go down there, I'm going to be able to actually walk in there and notice something analogous to, like, I know there's a different alcohol content in beer than there is in whiskey, right? And some days, some days I might want to go in and get some beer, and other days I might want to go in and get a bottle of whiskey. And I know, I sort of know what I'm getting into as I make that transaction. Same kind of deal in that shop in Northampton?
Yeah, and you don't have to go all the way to Northampton anymore. There's a store closer. I forget which town it's in, but it's 11 miles or so from Bennington.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, absolutely. The menu, I mean, you can punch it up online and look at it, and you can see the various THC levels.
I'm not really in the market these days, even, but if I decide to...
at the products, you can actually see the whole cannabinoid profile. If some people want to have CBD, or they find that other cannabinoids produce, you know, an improved experience for them, they're able to see that right on the label. And it's not all about getting the most THC possible. There's a subset of consumers that's interested in having as much THC as possible, but that's certainly not reflective of the overall market.
Yeah, yeah, and that's for sure. And I do think that there are probably, you know, the industry's going to respond if it's smart and frankly responsible with a range of and a well-labeled range. That's that would seem to be the way to go here if this is going to unfold, and it seems like it is unfolding as you describe it down in Massachusetts. We just have a few minutes left to go, and I do want to get into one other topic here, particularly with Cynthia Sievright, the director of alcohol and drug abuse programs at the Vermont Department of Health. Cynthia, there's been a lot of concern in the last couple of years, especially as the stronger strains of marijuana have become more so. I mean, I and Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, that's my sense, is that folks are coming out with some, there's at least in one segment of the industry, there's sort of a contest or something for strength.
I think that's been happening for decades, and it was happening, you know, most of the increases in potency happened during Prohibition, when there was no regulated market whatsoever.
Yeah, okay. But let me go to Cynthia on this, because Cynthia, I understand, is real concerned about mental health issues connected with heavy consumption of very high THC cannabis.
Yes, there are some concerns about that, but we've seen that it's not new. That's something that has been known about for a long time. The exact correlation between the THC and mental illness, I can't speak to that exactly, but we know that there is some correlation. And the stronger that the THC is, the stronger the effects on your brain and your behavior.
Yeah, someone I love got into trouble this way in the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years or so, and it was sad to see. I gotta say,
yeah.
So I that's something close to my own situation. Matt, I gather you're going to be talking to lawmakers again as they come back into session next month about moving. Moving on a regulated marketplace?
Yeah, the bill's still active. S-54, it passed the Senate 23-5 last year, earlier this year, I suppose, and the House leadership say they're going to bring it up early in January and bring it to a vote. Of course, we don't know if the governor is going to be on board yet. There are a lot of questions yet to be answered, but it certainly is possible, but not certain, that Vermont will move forward next year. So we'll be having a State House Advocacy Day kicking off on January 9th, asking people who care about this issue to show up in in Montpelier and try to talk to some folks.
And Cynthia Seawright, do you think that you, as speaking for the health department, I gather you occasionally go down to Montpelier and testify, will you be advising lawmakers to say, yes, we ought to have a regulated, tightly regulated retail market for cannabis in Vermont so that people know what they're buying, they know how much is in a given product, we can control how it's delivered in terms of maybe it shouldn't be in edibles that look like candy bars or whatever, or will that be something that you'll be advocating?
Our commissioner, Dr. Mark Levine, has the pleasure of being able to go to the State House and doing the testimony for the health department, and our deputy commissioner, Kelly Dougherty, will be there as well. Mm-hmm. And at this point, it's like I said earlier, if we're going to have a legalized marijuana in this state, we will support the regulation of that.
Okay. We kind of already do have legalized marijuana in the state. So
that's right.
This is kind of the natural next step, I guess.
It is, yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, Carol Seawright of the Vermont Department of Health, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Good talking with you. Matt Simon, I'm glad you were able to jump in as well and always offer an interesting perspective on this stuff also.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank the two of you. All right. We are fast approaching the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM on this Monday, December the 9th, 2019. I want to thank all of my guests this morning. Xander Landon came in first off from btdigger.org this morning. And we had Steve Dorsey from CBS News joining us for a little bit there. And then, of course, Carol Seawright from the Department of Health and Last Minute Edition, Matt Simon, all making good contributions to the program today. I really appreciate it. Hey, that's about it for our show. Stay tuned now for Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre, and we'll be back tomorrow morning with another edition of the Dave Graham Show. 9:05, be here or be square.